Welcome to the Image Doctors. This is episode number 42 for June 7th, 2007. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker. And welcome back.
Yeah, and today we're pleased to be brought to you by Hewlett Packard, manufacturer of the HP PhotoSmart B9180 wide format photo printer.
And many other nice printers.
So thank you to HP, and check out their full printer line at hp.com. Well, what are we going to talk about today, Rick?
Well, we've got several topics for you today. The first one that we'll go into will be a fairly beefy one, and that's on a subject that lots of people care about, which pertains to how to make good family portraits and group shots, and especially photos of kids. And so we'll talk about all sorts of things, camera settings, lighting, compositional tips, all of that kind of stuff. So that'll be a good one.
And then we're going to talk a little bit about some lenses that are useful as lightweight travel options, because it's getting to be summer and vacation and travel season, and sometimes you don't want to pack all your big glass for that.
Yep.
So we'll give some suggestions there, and of course we'll have our weekly photo prescription.
Right.
So let's get to it then and start talking about taking family pictures.
Right.
There's all kinds of, you know, that's probably the number one reason why people buy a camera.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at all the photos that are taken out there, they're the vast majority of them probably. I know in my case, I've got lots and lots of family photos that greatly outnumber, you know, the stuff I do of wildlife and landscapes and all that kind of stuff.
So we have a whole range of tips, and we'll start with the basic settings and hardware recommendations. Mm-hmm. And then we'll split it out talking about the difference between taking portraits and taking group shots and then taking pictures of your kids, which
right.
can be a whole different kind of photography when you think about it.
And a whole different kind of challenge, too.
Exactly. So let's start with camera settings. And we assume that you'll be using a Nikon, probably a digital body, but for the film shooters, we'll make some recommendations as well.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start with the digital recommendations first. For people pictures, I always recommend, and I think you do too, using color mode 1.
Mm-hmm.
So go into your settings and camera settings and find...
Or 1A.
Or
yeah.
1A.
Yeah, they're just a little bit different. You might want to play with them and see what you like best.
And if you're going to be emailing photos... 1A is a very good choice. Shoot in sRGB to begin with, and then you won't have to worry about doing fancy conversions from from the wrong color space. So that can save you some hassle on the front end if you set up that way.
And just to talk a little bit about that mode first, what it does is it lowers the contrast level a little bit, and it doesn't oversaturate colors, but it does give kind of a nice... warm, rosy tone to skin tones, whether they're lighter skin tones, you know, more the Scandinavian type, or even darker ones, both benefit from that setting.
It doesn't look very natural. It doesn't over pump up the reds.
Right.
And so that if you were to, conversely, if you were to shoot mode 3, your people might look kind of ruddy and reddish.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to stick with mode 1 for your people shots.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. And you mentioned the low contrast in mode 1.
Mm-hmm.
But we also recommend setting your camera to the low contrast tone curve.
Right.
And that's for two reasons. One is that it's easier to recover. It's easier to add contrast, as we mentioned in an earlier episode. It's easier to add contrast back later in post-processing if you need to.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll also capture more subtle detail.
Right.
You don't. Especially if you're outdoors in bright sunlight, you don't want harsh shadows or the appearance of harsh shadows blocking up in people's eye sockets.
Or their hair, too.
Yeah.
You'll really see a difference in the hair, and you'll just find that there's a lot more fine detail there if you use a lower contrast setting to start with.
Now, as far as the exposure mode you should be going into, consider shooting aperture priority.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably our favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what your subject is, you know, and the available light might dictate your f-stop. But in general, since the digital cameras are so good between ISO 100 all the way up to probably even 800, you know, I say set the ISO that is the lowest for the situation, but start with your aperture. And depending on your subject, if you're doing group shots, you're going to want to use probably a smaller aperture. So something in the order of F5, 6, or maybe F8 or even F11, mm-hmm. especially if you're doing one of those group shots where you want all of the distant objects, you know, you're standing on the mountain overlook or something and you want to have all the scenery and focus in the background, mm-hmm. consider using a smaller f-stop.
Pause for a sec.
On the other hand, if you're shooting more of a close-up portrait where you want the backgrounds to be more out of focus, consider opening up somewhere between f4 to 5.6, mm-hmm. maybe even a little more wide open than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, if you have a faster lens that you're using, you know, some shallow focus shots can be kind of interesting.
Just you have to be careful because you're going with the shallower depth of field, depending on how close you are to your subject, you have to be careful that you might not get both eyes perfectly sharp.
Yeah.
And that's not always a bad thing, but it's just something to keep in mind.
If there's a choice between, you know, the eyes, always go for the closest one to the
right,
camera.
The nearest
that
eye.
Sharp.
Now, a couple other little quick settings. If you're doing group shots, you're going to want to use single servo focus mode typically. Mm-hmm. That's the easiest way to allow you to lock your focus, recompose, and then shoot. Of course, you could also, if you've adopted the AF on button technique that we talked about last time, you know, that works equally well.
Mm-hmm.
And then consider a warmer white balance. Err on the side of being a little on the warm side.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean with your, if you're using auto white balance, consider auto -2, -1, -2, somewhere in there, because otherwise people look a little bluish.
Right.
And it's not good. Now, if you're shooting raw, you can go back and fix that. But if you're not shooting in raw, you want to err on the side of being a little bit warm.
Mm-hmm. And if you are doing raw processing, you know, don't just stick with that auto -2 or whatever setting. You consider sliding the temperature scale just a little bit more to the right for a little bit more warmth. Not a lot, but just a little.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a little bit in the tint setting too.
Don't overdo it, but it's good.
Right. Now, if you're shooting film, what you want to do is stick with a lower contrast film. And you know, some of the print films are really nice for that. Most of them are a little bit lower contrast than the slide films, but there are a few of them that Kodak and Fuji make that are specially intended for portraiture types of things, and they'll have a lower contrast amount. Those are the kinds that the wedding photographers will typically use. If you're shooting slide film, then you know, you'll want to do the same thing. Stay away from films like Velvia. If you're photographing people, unless you want a really weird look,
yeah.
You know, and go more like with a Cinzia or something like that, that's not quite as saturated and not quite as high of contrast, and you'll get nicer looks also. For film, you know, one of the things I'll recommend too is pop on a Nikon A2 warming filter. We've talked about those in the past, and those are great for photographs of people. It just gets a little bit more warmth, looks very natural. It's not overdone, and it's especially nice if you're using flash, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Mm-hmm. So that's your basic camera setup, and let's now talk about...
One quick thing, and it's jumping ahead slightly.
No problem.
So we won't spend a long time on it, but in terms of film choices, also think about black and white. We'll talk more about that later.
Right, that can be very, very useful for portraits. So... Those camera settings are pretty universal, mm-hmm. for the most part, regardless if you're shooting portraits or group photos or kids running around. It
right.
really doesn't matter. Where you start to, I want to focus a little bit now on talking about, well, let's start with the sort of the traditional family pictures, which are your group shots on your vacation.
Mm-hmm.
How do you want to get those right? What are things that you can do?
Mm-hmm.
First thing is, by a group shot, it means usually more than two or three people. You might have the whole family at a picnic,
mm-hmm.
Or it could just be, you know, stopping on your road trip, you know, getting outside in front of the sign at Yellowstone or something and says,
right.
Okay. So a lot of times people forget that with group photos, that they try to get every last little bit of the, you know, the people in the picture. And get the whole background, head to toe, and the whole background. And what ends up happening is you get your pictures back, or you look at your pictures, and there's, you know, you can't even recognize anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's really tiny in the frame, and maybe it's too dark. You know, they got shadows over their faces. Otherwise, a nice scene, but
right.
you kind of missed out something. So how can you improve it? So from a compositional trick, of course, is get get in a lot closer. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to get in closer and you want the background to still have, you know, the scenery in it, mm-hmm. consider using a wider angle lens.
Right.
Something down in the, if you're on digital, something in the 18 to 24 millimeter range. You don't want to use a wide angle lens for portraits. We'll talk about why later, but you would want to do this with the group shots, but get in closer than you think you need to be.
Yeah. A good thing to always think about when you're making a photo, and it doesn't matter if it's a family photo or whatever, is what's the picture of? Mm-hmm. And the answer can't be, it's kind of everything that I'm seeing. That's not a good answer.
Right. It's a picture of your family.
Right.
So make your family the subject of the picture. Right.
And if it's a picture of your family at Yellowstone National Park, and you know, one of the things that you always see people doing, as soon as they get to the entrance of the park, there's a nice park sign. They pull over and they get the shot of their family at Yellowstone. And that's cool too. But get in close. You know, have your family get right up by the area of the sign where it says Yellowstone National Park. And then just have only that and, you know, close-ups of their, you know, maybe from the chest area on up only. Don't be tempted to get all their feet and everything in there, too. You just lose impact.
Yeah, and invariably what happens is that in your effort to get all the feet in the frame, you're also getting a whole bunch of unwanted foreground, you know, mm-hmm. just dirt
right.
in the frame, too. And you would end up cropping it out anyway
right.
if you were going to do that after the fact. So that's a good thing for group photos. Now, what about those when you're outside at your company picnic or your family picnic or reunion or whatever you might be? I guess you don't usually take family pictures at your company picnic. That's kind of silly.
Yeah, if you bring your family, you do.
I guess you can. Mm-hmm. A lot of times these things are at the worst time of day to be shooting, you know, the middle of the day, harsh light, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
So two things we talked about before to take advantage of is one, bring your flash, and two, take advantage of shady spots. Mm-hmm. So the taking advantage of a shady spot is really easy. You just don't stand in the harsh sun.
Right.
And this is going to give you some advantages because people won't be squinting.
Right.
You know, they won't be looking in the sun, and it'll reduce the contrast so you won't have, you know, just real dark, harsh shadows on people's faces. Yeah. It just won't look natural.
Now, one thing that's kind of funny about that is many years ago, there were standard recommendations from companies like Kodak in particular about how to pose people and, you know, where to have the light coming from. And their recommendation was the light should be coming from over the photographer's shoulder. And, of course, hitting them smack in the face and making them squint and making them, you know, have harsh shadows and all of those kind of things. It's ignore that advice, I think, in general. It came from a point in time where the films were very insensitive to light. The cameras didn't necessarily have fast lenses, you know, all sorts of things. But, yeah, you got a photo, but, boy, it was ugly looking. And you've probably all seen those photos when everyone's squinting and their eyes right. are watering. So don't do that.
You know. This is not to say that you couldn't shoot your subjects in a relatively front-lit situation. You
right.
just don't want to position yourself with the sun at your back.
Right.
And the other thing that can happen if the sun is at your back is you can get your own shadow in the
right.
picture. And that looks
right.
kind of stupid, too, when you have the tripod shadow.
Absolutely.
Unless that's what you're going for.
Yeah.
Now, the other way around this is to have, when you have side-lit or even back-lit subjects.
Which you shouldn't be afraid of
yeah.
at all. Those are,
embrace that.
Yeah, those can be great-looking situations.
But you'll need to fix that by bringing your own light to the party.
Mm-hmm.
So consider then adding a speed light, mm-hmm. whether it's the little pop-up flash on your D80, which might be just good enough for if you're close enough to your subject, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Or a full-on, you know, SB800, SB600, SB400. And if you're outdoors, we've said this before, we recommend setting up the flash so that it is in TTL balanced mode, TTL BL, the balanced fill mode. And you can start with dialing in maybe a -1 flash exposure compensation. So you do that on the flash itself most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is not dialing in minus exposure compensation on your camera.
Right.
It's different. You're just trying to tone down the effects of the fill flash, let it fill in the shadows, but you don't want it to be overpowering. Otherwise, you'll have people that look like strange posters. You know, it'll look like a billboard or something. It's
right.
not right.
So they'll look like they've been pasted into the photo almost
yeah.
because the lighting is so different.
Now, if you're taking your group shot indoors, you want to do the reverse. You want to use regular TTL mode on your camera.
And probably no exposure compensation.
Exactly. You want to make sure that that's at zero. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll just end up underexposing the shot altogether.
Right.
And as we suggested in the past, if you're taking shots indoors and it's a little bit dark, considering going up to ISO 200 or even 400, mm-hmm. You'll avoid some of those dark black backgrounds that can really be kind of ugly.
Right.
So the backlight, as you mentioned, can be really, really fun, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of the things I like is that rim lighting on hair.
Oh, absolutely.
It can look really good.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And often, too, you know, we talked about the problem with front lighting and subjects squinting and things like that. With backlighting, there is no problem of that. With side lighting, it's not much of a problem. So the facial expressions are usually more relaxed and natural.
Now, here's a neat trick that you can do. What if you want to have your subject off center in a backlit situation and you're using your fill flash?
Mm-hmm.
If you were to meter off center, the camera wouldn't necessarily, in quotations, know that your subject was this dark foreground object, and it may ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a neat trick you can do on some of the Nikon cameras, and it's called flash value lock,
right.
FV lock. And you can assign it, like on the D2X, you can assign the flash value lock function to one of the custom function buttons on your camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's an option. And what that does is that you point the camera with the flash attached at your subject. You focus like you would. You pop the, and you push the FV lock button. And it will fire the pre-flash, and it will then lock the flash's output for your subject. Now you can recompose and shoot, and that flash output is locked based on what it saw coming back to it when your subject was in the center of your frame. And that's kind of a neat trick. I haven't tried that much, but I hear it works pretty well.
No, it does work well, and where it really helps is just when you were talking about your subject is off-center, and you've got something in the center of the photo, it's really distant, and what'll happen is it'll try to light up that center thing, and the person that's closer will end up overexposed. So, yeah, that's a good feature to get to know, because it will really help for these kinds of photos.
So check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that pretty much covers group photography. Is there anything else? Oh, well, one other thing that you had mentioned, mm-hmm. for when you're taking pictures of groups, what's the classic, you know, watch the birdie say cheese, right?
Oh,
you want,
yeah,
everybody to smile. Well, you had a good suggestion for making people appear more natural in the group, mm-hmm. photograph. And
yeah, it was a tip I heard a long time ago, and it's have a conversation with them. Don't ask them to all say cheese or queso or whatever, but have them talk to you a little bit. Pick out some silly topic. Something that's likely to make them laugh a little bit or whatever, but actually have an ongoing conversation with them. And you'll want to take several shots just to make sure you don't end up with an awkward expression, but it really does work well. It looks a lot more natural in the photo.
And one way that this can work to your advantage is if you're using a tripod. Because if you've got your camera set up on the tripod, you can move your head away from behind the camera and be, mm-hmm. actually interacting with the group as you take the picture. And a tripod and a cable release is a great way to do this.
Right.
Now, if you're not going to have your head in front of the camera, then there's a little trick you need to make sure that you do, which is to close the eyepiece. Use the eyepiece cover.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it might just be a little plastic accessory that came with your camera. And you said, what the heck is this? And,
mm-hmm.
maybe you threw it away because you didn't know what it was.
Right.
Or in some of the higher end cameras, they have a little lever that you can actually turn, and it has a little shutter that comes down, curtains that come down over the back of the eyepiece. And that will help you, especially if the sun is somewhat behind you. Because what's going to happen is that your light meter in your camera doesn't really care if the light's coming in through the lens or through the viewfinder, and you can mess up your exposure if that isn't closed off.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll also want to use that if you do the old tripod and put your camera on the timer trick.
Right.
And so make sure that you close that.
And if your
eyepiece.
Camera doesn't have one of those eyepiece shutters and you can't find the little cover that came with the camera, good piece of duct tape.
Yeah, or gaffer tape,
right,
which is easier to remove than duct tape.
Good point.
So those are some good,
yeah, but
good tips.
Talking a little bit more about what we were discussing with having the conversation, put your camera on a tripod, move away from the eyepiece. The great thing about that, too, is especially if you're using like a cable release or whatever, your subjects have a hard time telling exactly when you're going to take the photo.
Right. So it eliminates those forced poses. So you can
get into that
conversation
over a period of time and just click it at a time where you see some natural expressions and just keep doing that.
And if you've got more than about four or five people in your group, always take two or three shots.
At least.
Because somebody will be blinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just the bane of group photographers.
There's some people that are more sensitive to that than others, so definitely do that.
Okay. Now let's move to the next kind of family-oriented picture that you might want to do, and that's more of a traditional portrait. Mm-hmm. And these can be indoors, outdoors, and a lot of the same rules apply as far as lighting goes, but for portraits, the one thing that's real important to keep in mind is to use a longer focal length. You don't want to use a wide angle lens and then have to stand 2 feet from your subject. Right. And the reason why is because you will get beat on by your spouse if you do this, because all of a sudden your noses look big. You look like Toucan Sam.
Right.
Or eyes start to bug out, not particularly pleasing unless you're going for some sort of funhouse effect.
Yeah, unless you don't like your spouse, I wouldn't recommend this.
And traditionally, on film, the sort of traditional portrait length, focal lengths were 85 millimeters, 105 millimeters, even 135 millimeter were in that range were good focal lengths for portraits. Mm-hmm. It means you have to stand a lot farther away than you might think, but it makes for a much more natural-looking photograph.
Right. The problem with going any longer than those kind of focal lengths, and you know, you'll have to think in terms of digital things and divide what we just mentioned by 1.5. But the problem going longer than that is that the face starts flattening too much. And then it starts looking wrong for another reason. Mm-hmm. You know, the nose just doesn't look right and the ears don't look quite the right size in relationship to the eyes, and it's just not necessarily pleasing. So you can do it, but
I would say nothing over
not as nice.
200. I mean, you can use 200 millimeters for certain situations. If you really are trying to isolate your subject and not necessarily doing a close-up head and shoulder shot.
Right.
You know, it can work. The 200 can work quite well. I've seen some very nice portraits where you throw the whole background out of focus because you're shooting at a wider aperture. So, but usually with a portrait, that's what you want, a soft background. That's one of the things that really discerns a snapshot from a point-and-shoot camera from a photograph taken with a digital SLR. And we assume that as our listeners, you guys have moved up to digital SLRs or at least SLRs. And this is one of the reasons, one of the ways you can achieve that effect. You show the same picture taken with the point and shoot and something's wrong with it. It's because your point and shoot is probably using a flash and it's probably shooting at F8. And so everything is sharp, but it's the background is sort of too sharp.
Right.
And with a nice, short telephoto lens, whether it's your zoom or otherwise, you can really start to throw that background out of focus and get a nicer, more pleasing portrait.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the things that we talked about earlier with lighting apply to portraits as well, you know, including the flash settings. But there are a couple other things that are worth discussing. One, if you are indoors, consider using bounce fill flash. Mm-hmm. And you can do that for a small group too. You know, with a bigger group, it gets a little bit more difficult, but you can still pull it off. But probably it's most important with a portrait of a single person. And that's easy. Just, you know, find a wall or a ceiling that's not too far away from your camera. Hopefully it's white. Otherwise, you'll get some interesting light. Point your flash at it and take advantage of it. It softens the lighting very nicely. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, we talked about some diffusers and things like that.
Right. I was just thinking about that.
And I still think that's one of the simplest, nicest ways of getting lighting for a portrait setting indoors. It's just so dirt simple.
Yeah, and you can buy those actually from the Nikonians Pro Shop, so that's not a bad thing either.
Yep, that's where I got mine.
Diffusers work great, or a white or bounce card. Mm-hmm. Some of your speed lights might even have that little white card that you can pull out.
Right.
And that's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Because that'll help you get a catch light in the eye.
Yeah. And then the other thing that works really great is some sort of a reflector. And you can do all sorts of different things, frankly. Where you're going to use these predominantly is outdoors in a backlit situation or a side-lit situation. The probably the handiest thing, the most sophisticated, is to get some sort of a collapsible round diffuser reflector panel. The one I like a lot is it's called a 5-in-1, and it's made by Photoflex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty slick thing that includes a diffuser that lets light through several different reflector surfaces, including a white one, a silver one, one that's got a light gold tone to it.
To warm up your image.
Yeah. And then what you do with those, you know, if you're using it as a reflector, is that you have the reflector, you know, close by where you are. You've got this person that's backlit, and then you'll just kind of move the reflector around until you see the light filling up the shadows in their face.
Or more importantly, you have your assistant move the reflector
around. That's easier for sure.
That's the easy way to do it. And you know, a reflector could be as simple as a piece of white poster board.
Absolutely. It could be a white sheet. It could be all sorts of things. So,
you know, just something that's going to diffuse that light and fill in some of the shadows.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be something fancy. And you can always get a piece of slightly off-white, you know, maybe slightly yellowish poster board or something like that if you wanted a slightly warmer look. But it's amazing what it will do to the look of a portrait, make it look much more professional.
Yeah, I mean, there's when you're going to use flash, the one of the dead giveaways with using flash between the pro and the just the average peon like mm-hmm. me is the harsh shadows that are cast by
right.
the flash.
Right.
And the ways that you want to do this, another thing you can do besides the bounce, another thing you want to do is, or could try to do, is consider using your flash off the camera hot shoe.
Right.
That's going to give you two advantages. One is you can move the flash around so that the shadows aren't directly cast on the person's face.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing it's going to do is it's going to really eliminate any chance of red eye
mm-hmm.
if you're taking pictures in a dark room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that pop-up flashes are not good at all.
Right.
It's that they are going to cast harsh shadows because they're a very small point source of light.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be right near the lens axis. And so they tend to be a recipe for red eye.
Mm-hmm.
So try to do that. And there's lots of different ways to do that. The cheapest way is to get yourself a SC, was it 19, I think is the new one. Used to be the SC17, a sync cord.
Mm-hmm.
One end plugs into your hot shoe. The other end has a shoe for your flash. And then whether you hold that in your left hand while you're shooting with your right, or have it on a flash bracket of some kind, whatever you want to do, it gets that flash off the axis of the camera, and it just makes everything look a little nicer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you combine that with all your diffuser tricks and other things you can do, and it
right.
works really well.
And the talking to your subject idea still works well for portraits and stuff like that. One thing that you might want to do is have the camera slightly elevated relative to your subject and have them looking up slightly at the camera. This particularly helps avoid a double chin mm-hmm. kind of look. And so it's just, you know, just a slight adjustment there can make an
improvement. And it's interesting, if you've ever gone and sat through, you know, high school photos or whatever right. yearbook picture, whatever it might have been, that photographer, if they were any good, probably put you into some positions that felt really uncomfortable and
right.
quite contorted. But they
right.
did it for a reason. It's because they know the tricks to get rid of double chins.
Mm-hmm.
They know the tricks to get rid of belly rolls. And one of the things I did recently was purchase a book on portrait posing.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommend, I mean, there's lots of them out there. They're all going to be, you know, pretty decent. But take a look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that it says to do for portraits is to learn the poses yourself. And then there's lots of little tips that you can do, like don't have both feet planted on the ground if you're going to take a picture full length portrait. You know, there's lots of little things.
Is there a specific book that you would recommend?
Yeah. Yeah. The book that I purchased recently, I think I got this over the holidays and, you know, just went on Amazon and did a little search, is called Posing for Portrait Photography, a head-to-toe guide, and it's by a photographer named Jeff Smith, and he's got just about everything in there. If you're considering shooting portraits for yearbook or any other reason, He's got all the poses in here, starting with the head and working way down to full length portraits. So a lot of nice little tips about how to avoid, how to both accentuate features and hide them. Mm-hmm. Because depending on your subject, you might want to have a different kind of effect in your photograph.
Right.
So,
just thumbing through it right now, it looks like a pretty good book.
Yeah, it's very good. I haven't had too many opportunities to put it to use, but it's full of good ideas. Mm-hmm. And that's really the best way is to, go in. If you're going to do a portrait of somebody, be prepared. So understand what you're getting into. Don't
right.
just, when they leave and the portrait session is over and maybe your family flies back to wherever they go, where they live far away, you can't just do it over. And so having a book of posing will help you make those things look natural, even though it won't feel that way when they're,
right.
when they're doing those poses.
They'll be wondering if you've gone nuts or something.
But again, that rule of interacting with that idea of interacting with your subject while you're doing the shoot works really well.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to get really fancy, you can do what I did and buy some fairly inexpensive light stands and some small diffuser domes. I got these from Photoflex. It's the Light Dome Q39 or something like that. They're small. They're only about, I wouldn't say more than 18 inches. They're rectangular diffusers.
Mm-hmm.
But what's nice about them is I can put an SB800 into them and mount them on these stands. And with the wireless TTL, the Creative Lighting System, you can really start to have some fun setting up some lights without having to go and invest in a whole set of fancy studio strobes. Because,
right.
That's hardcore stuff.
Yeah.
Even though they
expensive.
Work really well, mm-hmm. That's overkill for most of us. Any other ideas for portrait tips, Rick?
I think those are the main ones. And now we'll talk a little bit about kids.
Yeah, which is almost going back to our sports photography.
Yeah.
Kids are sort of a combination of sports, wildlife, and all things in between. And so unless you're doing the formal sit-down posing session, usually your kids are running around doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you have to run around and follow them. And again, one of the reasons you probably bought your DSLR is because you were having a hard time with your point and shoot keeping up with your kids.
Sure.
So what things would be changed from our basic recipe?
Well, I think in some cases, we'll just remind listeners of a few of those again. Get closer. Can't emphasize that enough. You almost want to get unnaturally close. And then it'll be okay when you look at your photos. The talking to your subjects and interacting with them is a great thing. Do another variation on it. You might have them interacting with a toy or something like that.
Depending on how old the kids are.
Yeah, because attention span can sometimes be a problem. And, absolutely one of the things you want to do is get your equipment all set up, everything configured, all the settings in place, before you even really let them know that you're going to take a photo, because there's nothing more boring or frustrating to little kids than having mom or dad sitting there twiddling the dials on their camera and telling them, just a minute, and 5 minutes later you're ready to take a photo.
So be ready.
So be ready, but talk to your kids. Have give them a toy to play with, whatever. I used to take some nice shots of my son when he was little, and meaning like 18 months or 2 years old, in swing sets and stuff like that. That's a great way to use the continuous autofocus. But they're happy. I mean, they're smiling. You give them a little push back and forth, and you get some pretty cool shots.
You bring up a good point. Mm-hmm. For moving subjects, this is where you'll want to switch your focus to the continuous servo mode.
Right.
And go back to our last episode where we talked about the AF on technique. It could be very, very useful for this kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing you mentioned earlier that we've talked about, we didn't mention earlier, but we've talked about earlier for wildlife shots, is getting down at the subject's eye level. Well, the
right.
same thing applies for children, too.
Right.
Now, there are some shots where when the kid's looking up right at you, it's pretty darn cute.
Oh, yeah.
If you get pretty close and they're kind of looking up at you like, oh, mommy, it's like very adorable.
Yeah.
But that's a certain kind of shot. For everything else, get lower to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Be down at their level.
Right. And, one of the things that we probably should have mentioned with the other types of portraits, and it holds true with ones of kids too, watch the background. Watch for a clean, uniform background if you can. If you can find some nice green shrubbery behind him that will be out of focus. That'll look nice.
Can we get a nice shrubbery with a two-tiered effect, possibly? Possibly. Okay.
All right. And, you know, so that's something to look for with kids, too. You don't want a distracting background, something that appears to be growing out of the head, or just anything that competes for the attention in the photo.
And this is where having a faster lens might do you well.
With a little bit longer focal length. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just because you'll get that blurred background, mm-hmm. and it can be very, very nice.
Yep.
Again, you're trying to make photographs, not just snapshots. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to us.
Right.
That's the whole idea here. So, but all the other rules still apply. I mean, don't bullseye your subject. Mm-hmm. If the kid's looking, you know, running, mm-hmm. make sure that they're not running up against the edge of the frame. Make sure that they have some space to run to. Mm-hmm. The rule of thirds can work really well for you. And then all the other stuff, backlighting, your flash,
yeah.
get different angles, get different appearances on the photographs.
Right. And that brings up something that we hinted at a little bit earlier when we were talking about film, and that's black and white. Mm-hmm. Black and white looks wonderful for photos of people many times. Don't just think color. You know, if you are shooting digitally, the nice thing is if you've shot RAW or even with JPEGs, although it's a little bit nicer with RAW, you can always convert them to black and white.
That's right.
And, you know, if the lighting wasn't necessarily the best in terms of, you know, the color balance or whatever, or maybe it was a funny mix of lighting, like part incandescent, part daylight, black and white is the big savior there. And it can just look fantastic, I think, for photos.
Yeah, because then... color temperature really goes out the window once you go to black and white.
And it doesn't matter if it's your spouse or a group or especially little kids, black and white is cool.
And another nice thing about shooting black and white digitally speaking is that grain or noise or whatever you want to call it looks pretty good.
With
black and white.
Right.
Doesn't matter if it's color noise, luminance noise, whatever. It doesn't look bad. I mean, if you're indoors in a situation where you're shooting at ISO 1600 or something, mm-hmm. who the heck cares if there's some noise in there? Yeah. Convert it to black and white, and that'll look
and maybe add some more noise.
Yeah, maybe even do some more. That's right. Yeah.
Go for that 1960s photojournalist look. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tri-X film kind of look. It looks very, very cool.
It can be very nice if you do it the right way.
And if you are shooting film, you know, try some higher speed stuff to deliberately get that grain. It can be a very exciting look.
So there's lots of ways to do black and white conversions. Mm-hmm. Some of the new Nikon cameras will actually shoot black and white mode. And while it's okay, you might want to still process it further. The advantage of that is that it gives you a black and white preview on your screen. Mm-hmm. One word of caution on that is that if you're shooting RAW in the black and white mode, and you use something other than Nikon Capture or Capture NX to open your image, it's going to come out in color.
Right.
Because that black and white information is one of the tags that is applied into your NEF file that isn't read by other RAW converters.
Yeah, you can still convert
it. No problem. I mean, you can still convert it to black and white, but don't be surprised when your image that you took black and white in the camera comes out in color if it was in RAW.
Yeah.
So just so you're not freaking out there.
Yeah. Well, any other things that you can think of on that overall topic, family photos?
The one other thing that I want to bring up, and this applies for all these situations, but outdoor mm-hmm. pictures particularly, doesn't matter if it's portraits, group shots, kids running around, is the old advice that you used to get on school picture day. You get a little letter saying, you know, dear Mr. and Mrs. Odell, next Friday is school picture day. Please make sure your kid has, you know, bathed and combed their hair, etc. But it
kind
always
of an unusual
said,
thing for their son Jason, probably. That's
right. But what it always said was, if at all possible, do not send your kid to school in a white T-shirt mm-hmm. or a white shirt, because the issue of exposure. So you got one person in a white T-shirt on a bright sunny day, it's just a recipe for blowing out highlights, and it just won't look very good. Yeah. It just won't have that same. Now overcast days, no big deal. I mean, now you know why. I mean, wedding photographers have such a hard time. You got a groom in a black tux and a white gown on your bride, and it's the middle of the, you know, it's a nice sunny afternoon, outdoor wedding, and geez, what do you do?
But, But, locked up shadows and blown highlights.
But, yeah. You know, those things you can do. And then the other thing I would recommend is, hey, if you can do portraits at the golden hour, do them.
Yeah.
That, especially for that backlighting you were talking about.
With that reflector and everything.
It looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I think that pretty much covers it. If you've got any more questions for us about that or want to suggest, point out issues in a anything we forgot on this topic, drop us an email at talkradio@nikonians.org and we'll gladly answer it on the air.
Yep, or in our podcast feedback forum.
That's right.
Site.
Okay, so quickly now let's move on to, it's summertime and let's talk about travel lenses, some lightweight champions. Mm-hmm. Because as much as you love our big 28 to 70s and 17 to 55 and 70 to 200s, sometimes that can be awfully darn impractical, especially if you're on a family kind of vacation where photography isn't the sole reason that you're going.
Right.
So we got some suggestions and we've been looking at what we've been using and you have every lens ever made. So what are some of your favorites, Rick, for when you're traveling, when you want to go light?
Well, I think it's hard to beat the old 18 to 70.
The kit lens that came originally with the D70?
Yeah, awfully nice lens. It's really very sharp. It's very compact. It's a very nice focal length range for travel, you know, unless you need something really long. It's just hard to beat it, and they are dirt cheap on the used market. I picked up mine for, I think, $175 in mint condition. I mean, perfect. It's a great little lens. It's a nice one just to have around the house, too.
Yeah.
Works great for those family photos.
Nice compact. Mm-hmm. Now another one, if you got a little more money to spend, would be something
quite
like the 18-200 VR. Right. But that really is the put that one lens on your camera and you can pretty much go wherever with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly bigger.
But it's not that big.
No,
it's still pretty compact.
It's still not like a heavy 2.8 Pro
it's
lens.
Comfortable.
But it has the advantage of having that VR in it. Mm-hmm. Which, as we'll remind you, it's great for taking handheld shots of things that aren't moving.
Right.
But if as the light gets really low, you got to understand that the VR will not stop your subject from, you know, so motion blur from your subject can still influence the picture. You just won't have too much camera shake issues.
Right. And that helps. It'll give you the equivalent of about 3 or 4 stops more shutter speed.
So, and that can be really important, especially if you're on vacation. So that's really a great, just sort of all around, put it on your camera and forget about it.
And sometimes you'll see debates about, you know, how sharp it is. It's fine. It is absolutely fine.
Oh, it's a very good lens from everything I've heard.
Yeah.
And depending on which focal length you use it at, it's going to rival some of the better pro lenses.
Yeah.
So it's recommended, but it costs a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Another option, if you're going somewhere and you want the really wide, then you probably want to get like a 12 to 24.
Or 10 to 20.
The Sigma 10 to 20. The Tamron 11 to, what is it that we rated, that we reviewed? It was 11 to 18 or something?
Something like that.
Something like that, made by Tamron. Very light lens. Mm-hmm. If weight is an issue, that one's very, very light.
And it's probably not going to be the single lens that you take. You know, if you're only taking one, probably one of those first two that we mentioned is a better choice. But as a supplementary lens, especially if you're in urban settings where the shooting conditions are kind of tight, can't move back, something like that is a good way to go. And usually they're not too heavy or big.
Yeah, I mean, when I was shooting film, something like a 24 millimeter lens was a very nice focal length, and a 24 millimeter prime, the Nikon AFD 2.8 is relatively inexpensive and very lightweight and very compact. It's just that when you use it on a digital body, you're not quite as wide. So if you need something in that wider angle, then that's a good option.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple lenses out that are relatively new, specifically made to be used with the DX format, and they're made by Sigma and Tokina, and they're in that 50 to 150 or 50 to 135 kind of range. So what they're attempting to do is, and they do well, is replicate that old 70 to 200 kind of lens, you know, where you didn't need something that was really long, you want something that's maybe a little bit more compact. And both of these are f2.8 lenses. So yeah, pretty quick.
And because they're designed for the digital bodies, they are smaller and somewhat lighter than you would be having with your traditional 70 to 200.
Yeah,
lens.
And by the way, they make great portrait lenses.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And from what I've heard of both, you know, they're both sharp and well-made, and I haven't used them, but I mean, both companies make good stuff, but that would be a nice travel lens. You know, it's not as big as a big old 70 to 200 2.8 VR lens, which is huge.
Now, the last one on our list is one that you've got, and my dad has this lens. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a travel lens, but...
But there's certain kinds of travel situations.
Right. Now, if you are doing going somewhere where wildlife or birds or whatever might be in part of the equation, like you're going on a family vacation to a national park, and you don't want to lug your big 200 to 400 around, or certainly you can't afford it, then by far the nicest, most compact lens out there that gets you that kind of focal length is the 80 to 400 VR.
Right.
And this was Nikon's first VR lens, if I recall. And it's got a... it's pretty versatile, and for a couple of reasons. It'll work on all the older bodies reasonably well. It might not, the VR might not work on the older bodies, but it has a screwdriver autofocus.
Right. And it has an aperture ring.
And it has an aperture ring. So if you're using an older film body, it would work just fine if you didn't have a command dial. So you can use it that way. But it's surprisingly lightweight and compact for a lens that gets you out to 400 millimeters.
Right.
And on digital, that's a 600 millimeter lens.
Which is a lot.
And this thing will fit easily into, you know, just about any camera bag.
Right. Configuration that it has when it's at the shortest focal length, it's a lot smaller than a 70 to 200 VR. And yet you get that 400 millimeter focal length.
And this lens gets a little bit of undeserved criticism because it's not an AFS lens and it's not a fast aperture lens, so it doesn't autofocus as quickly as some of the newer ones would. But by golly, I've seen pictures from this lens and it is sharp.
Yeah,
and it's a very good lens.
And I've used it on, you know, lots of trips, including up to Alaska and things like that, and it's just really nice. It's so comfortable and convenient to use.
It's the kind of lens you could easily take on a hike if you expected to see some wildlife.
Right.
And it would work great.
Just understand its limitations. It's not going to be the best for rapid sports photography, but for the majority of wildlife situations, it works great.
Mm-hmm. It really does.
Yeah.
So those are our just top of the list, you know, right off the top of our head, suggestions for some good travel lenses. If you've got a favorite travel lens, you know, feel free to drop us a note and let us know what you think. But but I think that's, you know, just for a starter of list of things, you can get by with some very good quality and fairly inexpensive options for some of these.
Right.
Especially that 18 to 70.
Oh, yeah. Such a bargain.
So that brings us to that time of the show where we give you our weekly photo prescription.
Right.
And this time we came up with some ideas that are software suggestions. And it involves keyboard shortcuts. And I love keyboard shortcuts because I can do a keyboard shortcut with my left hand while keeping my mouse on the right hand, and I'm not always moving the mouse up and down all over the screen. And if you have a larger monitor, that's really handy.
Right.
I never go file save anymore. I always go command or control S. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I've gotten in the habit of doing that. And then there's a lot more.
Right.
But specifically, in a big picture kind of way, a lot of the photo digital applications, whether it's Photoshop or Capture NX or Lightzone, they use a lot of the same keyboard shortcuts. Mm-hmm. Things like zooming in, you know, control plus, control minus, or zoom the image to fit the screen, control zero,
right,
or command zero if you're on a Mac. I mean, a lot of those are conserved, you know, save, copy, paste. Those commands are always the same. But if you're using Photoshop, you even get one even more added benefit. And that's, you can assign a custom function key or custom, you know, keyboard shortcut to any of the menu items that you want.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, came that way or otherwise.
Yeah. And one that I use a lot is one that doesn't come in Photoshop. But, you know, very frequently I've got an image where I've, you know, put some layers on it, you know, maybe for curves or levels or adjusting saturation or sharpening or whatever. And so I've got a whole bunch of them, and I'm getting the point of wanting to print it or whatever, and I want to flatten it. And without some custom keyboard shortcut, you've got to go into the menus and then flatten all the layers. Or there are a couple other ways to do it, but all of them involve several keystrokes. And what I've done is I've just recorded a or set a keyboard shortcut, which is Control F on the PC. And when I do that, it just flattens all the layers. And it's very simple. And I use that all the time. So it's a big time saver. And normally that thing defaults to, I think, last filter or something like that.
So you've actually taken a keyboard shortcut that was already being used and set it.
But it's one that I would never care to use.
Overwrote it, right.
Yeah.
Now, the way you do this in Photoshop is you go to the Edit menu at the top of the screen. You go to Edit, and there's almost at the bottom of the list, it says Keyboard Shortcuts.
Yeah.
And then it pulls open this big dialog box with pretty much just anything and everything that's in there.
Right.
And then you select... You highlight the item that you want to set a shortcut to, and then you simply press the keystroke combination, whether it's a function key or command or control, whatever it is, command, shift, you can assign all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it'll set, and it will warn you if you're overriding one that's already defaults to something else, and then you can just decide whether or not you want to keep that and choose a different key or override it altogether and go with what you chose.
Yeah, but that's one I find really handy, so that's my tip of the day. But the broader one would be, you know, learn some of your keyboard shortcuts, at least a subset you're going to use frequently, and get into the habit of using those as opposed to the menus.
Because it really does speed things up.
Yep.
Streamlines your workflow.
Okay.
Okay, well, I guess we've come to the end of another show.
Yep.
Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to vote for us on Podcast Alley if you haven't done so already.
Yep, we appreciate that.
We need your feedback. And as always, send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org. And don't forget to read the show notes in the Nikonians blog page. And until next time, we'll see you later.
All right, bye-bye.